Hello and welcome to the TA teleconference, Generating and Refining Research Ideas, Part 1, presented by Dr. Sonia Foss, Professor of Communication at the University of Colorado, and Dr. William Waters, an Assistant Professor of English at the University of Houston Downtown. Sonia's research and teaching interests are in contemporary rhetorical theory and criticism, feminist perspectives on communication, the incorporation of marginalized voices into rhetorical theory and practice, and visual rhetoric. She is the author or co-author of the books Destination Dissertation, A Traveler's Guide to a Done Dissertation, Rhetorical Criticism, Contemporary Perspectives on Rhetoric, Inviting Transformation, Feminist Rhetorical Theories, and Women Speak. Her essays and communication journals have dealt with topics such as invitational rhetoric, agency in the film Run Lola Run, feminine spectatorship in Garrison Keillor's monologues, visual argumentation, and body art. Dr. Foss earned her PhD in communication studies from Northwestern University and previously taught at Ohio State University, the University of Oregon, the University of Denver, Virginia Tech, and Norfolk State University. William's research and teaching interests are in writing theory and practice, the history of the English language, linguistics, and modern grammar. He is the co-author of Destination Dissertation, A Traveler's Guide to a Done Dissertation, and was managing editor of La Puerta, A Doorway into the Academy. He also has published several poems in national journals. Dr. Waters earned his PhD in language and linguistics from the University of New Mexico and previously taught at the University of Maine, University of College in Galway, Ireland, and Cheongbuk National University in Korea. Sonia and William present the TA-sponsored workshop, Destination Dissertation, Practical Strategies for Writing the Thesis and or Dissertation, and Sharing Results, Crafting an Article. They also offer individual coaching. I will email all participants Sonia and William's contact information following the teleconference, and it will also be posted with the recording. Sonia and William will be presenting the second part of this teleconference on Monday, October 12th from 10 to 11 a.m. Central Time. I now turn the teleconference over to Sonia and William.
Hello, everyone. This is Sonia. Thank you for joining us today. And thanks to TAA for sponsoring this workshop and especially to Kim for handling all of the logistics. I'd like to let you know a couple of format things before we begin. First, you'll see that you have an outline of the major ideas that we're going to cover today in handout number one. So you might want to pay attention to that as we go through the workshop because it will help you keep track of where we are. And second, we'll stop about halfway through to take questions on what we've covered so far, and then we'll have time at the end again for a few questions. So please jot down your questions as they occur to you, and you'll get the chance to ask them at two points during the workshop. Okay, so let's get started.
Obviously, when you think about generating and refining research ideas, you want the ideas you develop to fit into a research program. A coherent program or research or an agenda that is generally focused around a theme or question you're trying to answer. If you don't have tenure, of course, you're going to be asked to articulate the focus of your research program in the research statement you write when you submit your materials for review.
So how do you get a research program going? When you're thinking about generating ideas for new projects, you want to think about what is guiding your research efforts or what theme connects the research that you've done so far and the research you're planning to do. The point of publishing isn't just to get published, but it's to share an idea and to make a contribution to understanding in your field. So try to come up with what you want that contribution to be across all or most of your research projects.
We think there's a nice little formula you can use to help you frame your research program, and it involves three steps. This is the second handout that we've given you, and you'll see on the left-hand side, the three steps are, first, you name your topic. I am studying blank. Second step, you imply your question, because I want to find out who, how, or why. Third step is, you state the rationale for the question and the project in order to understand how, why, or what. The quick example we give you on the right-hand side of the formula says, I am working on analyzing the film Run Lola Run because I want to discover the various options for agency it presents. in order to understand the relationship between communication and agency. Be careful when you develop your research program that it's something that won't alienate external reviewers when you go up for tenure. I'll use Sonia as an example. One kind of work she does is feminist scholarship, but when she started in the academy, feminism wasn't seen as very legitimate. So she deliberately didn't include a label in her description of her research program. Instead, she said that her research program was about questioning and expanding the boundaries that are constructed around theories and methods in communication. This allowed her to do feminist scholarship, which is all about questioning and expanding theoretical and methodological boundaries. And it also allowed her to do work in the area of visual rhetoric, which at the same time was also a way of expanding boundaries because her field only studied discourse and language for a very long time.
Now, of course, to have a research program, you're going to have a number of articles published, which means that you'll constantly have to keep coming up with ideas for new research projects. And this scares many new scholars, and we're guessing it's probably why you chose to join us on this teleconference today. You might be thinking, well, you had enough trouble coming up with a topic for your dissertation, so how are you going to keep coming up with ideas one after the other for all of those articles and book chapters and maybe books that you're going to be producing throughout your career? Well, what we'd like to do in our time together is to suggest five ways for coming up with research ideas. And we're going to go quickly over the first four methods, and we'll spend most of our time on the fifth one because we think that's the way that most scholars get ideas for research projects.
The first method is starting out with a question. This, of course, is the easiest way to come up with an idea for a research project. A research question just comes to you. You're interested in finding out about something, so you design a study that helps you answer the question, or at least allows you to begin answering the question. For example, you might be interested in figuring out how to reduce youth violence, and you want to know what kids themselves would think would reduce youth violence. So you design a study where you get kids to generate ideas about reducing youth violence. Or perhaps you're interested in how communicators can design messages for audiences they know might be hostile. You might choose to study, for example, a speech by the Pope to a group of U.S. nuns who want to be priests. Or you might study a pro-union essay speech to anti-union audiences. Obviously, research questions provide the starting place for research projects that but these don't occur to us that often, so we need to have other places to go to develop research ideas.
A second method for generating research ideas is to start with literature. You are doing reading. You are reviewing literature in a particular area, and the studies that have been done before prompt you to generate a question. So you might think to yourself, well, this study that I'm reading about now produced these findings, but it didn't do anything with this variable or with this population over here. So I wonder what would happen if that were included in the study. So I'll give an example. Let's say that you are reading literature that says that African Americans experience depression less frequently than whites. And this, by the way, is a real finding. The literature in this area might raise a question for you. Well, do blacks seek treatment for depression at the same rates as whites? So this question then that arises from your reading of the literature could then become the question for a new research project.
A third method for generating ideas for research projects is what we call the conceptual conversation. This is a conversation that you would have with someone to come up with ideas and work out the plan for a research project. A conceptual conversation involves a conversation with you and the partner. Partner can be anyone, a faculty colleague, one of your cohorts from your graduate program, or even your partner or spouse at home. To have the conversation, you simply set aside a block of time in a place where you won't be interrupted. Your partner asks you questions such as, what personal experiences have you had that were particularly significant or meaningful for you? What courses did you take in your graduate program that you found most exciting? What theories and concepts are most interesting to you? Do you have ideas for specific data, texts, or artifacts that you'd like to study? Are there resources to which you have access that could provide participants or data for your study? Does your job offer any of these resources? How about any kinds of activities? As you answer the questions, your partner encourages you to keep talking by asking you follow-up questions that are exploratory in nature, that are open-ended and genuine. They should encourage you to keep talking about your interests. If you keep going long enough, you'll be able to come up with a topic and the key pieces of the research design for that new project.
A fourth method for generating ideas is to keep what we call a promise file. As you are working on one research project, doing reading and collecting and coding data, for example, ideas and questions are going to occur to you. Jot them down and stick them in a file, a promise file. You promise that you'll come back to them and pursue them in future research projects. So when it's time to begin developing your next research project, it's great fun to thumb through the file and review all of the ideas that you had that you've probably forgotten about. And you're likely to find that there's something there that can be used to design a new research project.
We're going to spend the most time on a fifth method of generating research ideas because we think it's the method that most scholars actually use for coming up with research ideas, whether they know it or not. It's a method that works for both qualitative and quantitative research. It's what we call the generative method of coming up with ideas. This is a method where you encounter curious data and you generate the idea, the method, and the explanatory schema for the research project from the data themselves. The generative method involves 8 steps, and we'd like to take you through those steps in some detail. In this first teleconference, we'll cover the first 4 steps, and in the next teleconference on October 12th, we'll finish up the process and describe the next 4. Overall, the 8 steps are encountering a curious artifact, and what we mean by artifact is a text, data, or anything that can be analyzed. Second step is coding that artifact in general to discover the key pieces that need to be explained. Third step is searching for an explanation that holds the pieces together. Fourth step is creating an explanatory schema. The fifth step is formulating a research question from the explanatory schema. Sixth step is coding the artifact in detail to test the schema. Seventh step is searching the literature to connect your schema to conversations in your field. And finally, the 8th step is framing the study to write it up.
In the first step of this generative method, you encounter some kind of data or text or an artifact that raises questions for you. Maybe you encounter survey results that surprise you, you read something that really inspires you, or you encounter examples of something that makes sense to you. You discover data or a conclusion or claim of some kind that is appealing to you, that generates a sense of uneasiness, intrigue, or amazement, or that seems unusual in some way. Encountering the study that shows that African Americans in the U.S. have lower rates of depression than whites would be an example. This finding, this conclusion, surprises you because you would think that given discrimination in the country and its potential impacts, blacks would have higher rates of depression.
So for some reason, an object or phenomenon is prompting you to think about some ideas and you want to understand them better. Two communication scholars, Elizabeth Walker-Mefkin and Jay Mefkin, give a good example of how they use this generative method to come up with research ideas. As they explain it, quote, "The puzzling texts present themselves first. We do not begin with a theory or method of hypotheses and then search for a case study to demonstrate or illustrate the theory," end quote. They explain how they desired to analyze the civil defense campaigns of the 1950s using this method. They both remember their parents' absurd efforts to protect their families from nuclear attack, including their development of a plan to evacuate the children from school and the creation of a bomb shelter out of the closet, complete with mattress shoved up against the door. As they explain this, "It is the madness we sought to understand. How could our parents, perfectly reasonable people, act in this way? How could we, cynical pre-adolescents then, also take this world as natural? How are we so easily socialized into nuclear culture? The questions are real and troubling and led us to settle on the civil defense campaigns and resistances as the texts we would analyze.
We can give you another example of this from our own experience. Because we're in the communication and English disciplines, our research often involves analyzing texts like speeches, documents, films, poems, and architecture for what they tell us about how communication works. We got the idea for a recent research project when we saw the film Run, Lola, Run. This was a German film that came out about 10 years ago. The film is about Lola, who gets a phone call from her boyfriend, whose name is Monty, and Monty tells Lola that he needs a huge sum of money within 20 minutes or he will be killed by his mobster boss. So Lola takes off running to try to get the money, and she makes three of these runs in this movie. And in each run, she encounters the same people in different ways, and there are dramatically different outcomes for each run.
What's interesting for this method is we went to Run, Lola, Run to be entertained and had no intention of writing an article about the film. When it was over, however, we knew we really liked the film, but we couldn't say why. We couldn't really explain why it resonated with us as it did. We knew that the three runs represented three different perspectives on something, but we couldn't figure out what those were. We also couldn't get the film out of our heads. It continued to nag at us until we finally gave in to its demands and did a research project using the film as our data. We'll tell you more about that focus and about our focus in that project in a few minutes.
So the defining characteristic of an artifact that intrigues and interests you is likely to be something that doesn't fit or that breaks a pattern. Perhaps you like an artifact and you can't explain its appeal for you. Perhaps you can't figure out why an artifact had the effect that it did. Maybe you encounter an artifact that seems to violate much of what you know about something, but it seems to work anyway. Maybe an artifact disturbs or angers you, but you can't say why.
So after encountering an artifact like this that you can't adequately explain, your next step would be to use the generative method to do an initial broad brush coding of the artifact. Coding here means that you notice and interpret the major features of the artifact. The features you notice should include some of the major dimensions or components of the artifact that would have to fit into whatever explanation you develop to understand that artifact. As part of this process, think about what you immediately remember about the artifact after encountering it only once. As you examine the artifact, look for what topics are treated and the order in which they appear. Look at the lengths of various segments and the significant words and images that mark the artifact. This broad brush coding happens in quantitative research too, but we're going to focus here in our discussion on just the qualitative research for now.
In this process of identifying major features of the artifact, use intensity and frequency as your selection criteria. Intensity guides you to look for aspects of the data that seem important or significant, those aspects that stand out in the artifact. Also pay attention to frequency and look for patterns, things that are repeated in the artifact and that show up with some regularity. Because these recur, you might guess that they're somehow important in the artifact. Code the artifact according to intensity and frequency several times. Each examination will produce more information about the artifact's major elements, how they change over the course of the artifact, and the relationships and contradictions among the elements.
In our initial coding of Run, Lola, Run, we watched the film several times, and as we watched, we wrote down images, dialogue, and events that seemed to stand out, features that met the criterion of intensity. We guessed, for example, that the fact that Lola makes three runs is important. And of course, in this case, the three runs also constitute a pattern that we would notice as we paid attention to as frequency. We noticed that Lola encountered several people along her runs and thought these various characters might be important. So we noted who they were and what they did in each run. Time seemed to be very important because Monty only has 20 minutes to produce the required money. So we noted that. At the beginning of the film is a scene involving a soccer game, so we also include the game in our coding, thinking it might be significant, especially since at the end of the film, there's a game of roulette that appears. We noted that Lola and Manny seem to be on the outside of mainstream society because they do not have regular jobs, they have just a little bit of money, and they dress in Euro trash clothing.
We also notice patterns in the film where the same objects, events, or qualities appear repeatedly. And we wrote these down, so we were coding for frequency. The color red initially seemed important in the film. Lola's hair is bright red. The telephone she answers at the beginning of the film is red. And the liminal bedroom scenes between each of the runs are filmed through a red filter. The color red then appeared to constitute a pattern. Guns used in various ways also seem to be a pattern. A gun shows up in Monty and Lola's robbery of a grocery store in the first run. A gun shows up in Lola's effort to get money from her father in the second run. And a gun shows up in Monty's effort to retrieve his lost money from a tramp in the third run. So we noted these and other patterns in the film.
After identifying the major features of the artifact, the next part of the coding process is to interpret those features. You also could think of the two aspects of this process as presented and suggested elements. The presented elements are the data of what you observe, what you actually see. And the suggested elements are what they evoke or refer to. You might write a paraphrase, phrase, or label that describes what you are seeing in a passage, quotation, or image, and then what it means. You can write your codes in the margin of the text or another piece of paper, or if you're using a film or TV program, website, or visual image, you'll need another piece of paper and write down the codes on there. Our coding of the first run of Run Lola Run, for example, produce the following features and their interpretations of those features. So our first feature that we saw was a menacing-looking clock. We interpreted that feature as meaning time as a monster. Another feature we saw was that Manny turns down an offer of 500 marks from a friend. Our interpretation of that was that Manny refuses resources. Another feature that we saw was that Lola stops for men carrying a pane of glass across the street. Our interpretation was a glass ceiling or an obstacle. Finally, we saw that Lola kneels before her father to ask him for money, and we interpreted that as adoption of a low-status position on the part of Lola. Sometimes, this process of interpretation can be done very quickly, almost intuitively. You just see something and know what it means. If you're not very familiar with your artifact, though, you might need to do this process more deliberately, as we did when we wrote on all the things with Run Lola Run.
As you develop your interpretations of the features, try not to bring in other people's theories. Stay focused on the data of your artifact. Now, obviously, you can't clear your mind of everything that you know about your discipline and theories in your discipline as you code. But as much as possible, let the data reveal insights to you independent of any preconceived theories. This will ensure the originality of the explanation you develop. Be careful about coding according to what you want to find or what you're certain you will find. If you know what you're going to find, you already have your explanation for the artifact, and you don't need to keep going.
Remember, when you go to write this up, you'll have to be able to explain how you came to your interpretation of the data. Your interpretive claims will have to make sense to someone else. So frequently ask yourself as you go along, could I explain this to someone else so that they would be able to see how I moved from my observations to the interpretation that I've given them? For example, I just talked about Lola kneeling before her father to ask for money as evidence of her adopting a stance of inferiority or low power. If someone were to ask us how we came to this interpretation, we could explain that low-status people tend to engage in nonverbal behavior that suggests their low power. And kneeling is a classic sign of that stance. We could also argue that the person who is physically located above another tends to be the one with higher status. You don't need to go through this detailed process with every interpretation of every feature of your artifact, because much of it's just going to happen to make sense intuitively. But This is a process you should be able to do for any kind of skeptical reader.
Okay, what we suggest you do next is to make a list of all of your codes and their interpretations, and then get out your scissors and physically cut the observations you have made apart so that each idea or observation is on a separate strip of paper. And then what you want to do is to group the strips that are about the same thing and put them in one pile, and put all of the strips of paper that are about another topic in another pile. And you want to keep doing this until all of the strips are sorted into piles. Then you want to give labels to your piles. Name them with a word or a phrase that captures what you are seeing in the codes that you made, that made you want to group them together. So in our case, for example, after we cut our codings apart and began putting them in piles, we had a number of piles or categories, and they included things like material conditions as threats and obstacles, refusing help, communication strategies doomed to fail, and assumption of an inferior position.
These categories will enable you to begin to see the general themes that categorize the artifact. At this end of the initial coding process, though, you have a set of broad features, ideas, or topics that you believe might serve as clues to the explanation, but you don't have the explanation. Something seems to be going on in the artifact in terms of these features that you believe will develop into an explanation. At this point, however, you don't yet see a pattern that puts the features together. For example, we ended our initial coding process thinking that Run Lola Run might have something to do with feminism or gender or relationships between marginalized and dominant groups. We thought maybe rhetorical strategies used by subordinate groups was a key idea, or that agency was an idea. We saw time as playing a role, and we thought games might be a part of it because our initial coding produced piles of observations and interpretations in each one of those categories.
At this point, you might want to mark in some way which slips of paper are in which piles so that you could recreate those piles if you want to. And then what we suggest is that you mix all of those slips of paper up again and sort them again to force yourself to come up with another way of organizing your interpretations. You might want to feature different ideas, downplay others, interpret features differently, and try to capture different kinds of possible relationships among the codes. What this process does is it encourages you to stretch beyond an initial obvious way of categorizing the observations and interpretations and to open up other possibilities for seeing your data.
There are many other categories in which we could have grouped our observations and interpretations of the first run in Run Lola Run. A different category, for example, from the data noted above, might have been a label such as lack of support for others, which could include the codes of Lola's father shaking his head no, Manny taunting Lola, and Manny turning down a friend's offer of money. We're going to stop for a moment and check to see if there are any questions about the process we've described up until now, and then after we answer those questions, we'll pick up with searching for an explanation and continuing. Any questions?
I just wanted to remind everyone to press 4-star to unmute themselves to ask a question.
Sonia, maybe we're good.
Okay, should we go on?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so your next task is to search for an already existing or conventional way to explain the artifact. An explanation is likely to come in the form of a theory or a construct from a theory. Now, if you've been a scholar in your discipline for a while, you will bring to an artifact a repertoire of ideas and tools that can serve as possible explanations. If you are not yet very familiar with a set of theories that seems relevant to your artifact, you might want to do a miniature literature review at this time to see if theories or concepts exist that can explain to your satisfaction your curiosity about your artifact and you're focusing here on those piles of those strips of paper or the general interpretations and themes that you've been working with. In addition, theories and concepts from outside your discipline may be relevant in your search for an explanation. Investigate journal articles and books related to the categories of themes that your coding of the artifact revealed. Research that's been done on the artifact itself or on similar artifacts also might offer useful explanations.
Let's give you an example using a communication theory. So you might discover in an artifact, for example, elements that suggest to you that there's a theory of feminine communication style. This is a theory developed by Carolyn Coors Campbell. You then would look into that artifact for features of a feminine communication style and construct your explanation from this application.
Now, when you analyze an artifact using already existing concepts or theories, the temptation is often to engage in what is sometimes called cookie-cutter research, where all of the artifacts studied through the lens of the same method or theory come out looking exactly the same. For example, if you decide that what is going on in a speech by Barack Obama that is most significant has something to do with his use of the characteristics of a feminine style, then you'll focus your analysis on the components of Carolyn Coors Campbell's notion of a feminine style. And this is a style that includes five components: a personal tone, use of personal experience, anecdote, and examples as evidence, an inductive structure, audience participation, and identification between speaker and audience. So you'll be looking for those characteristics in your analysis. Likewise, if you're analyzing a poem by Maya Angelou and something in the poem suggests that a feminine style might be part of the explanation for what intrigues you about it, again, you would analyze the poem for those five components. But you would have molded your artifact into one where what is significant about it has to fit into those five components. When you do this, you risk missing more significant and interesting things in your artifact. In addition, when you make the data fit the theory, your research sometimes illustrates the theory more than it illuminates your artifact. With such an approach, you usually aren't encouraged to go beyond the confines of those concepts or theories for an explanation for your artifact.
And so what usually happens is that your search for a conventional explanation doesn't produce one that satisfactorily explains the artifact. We thought for a while, for example, that Run, Lola, Run could be explained by the three views of love and rhetoric that come from Plato's Phaedrus. But we not only discovered that these three views of rhetoric didn't begin to explain what was going on in film, but also that analysis built around this theory largely would have illustrated only Plato's theory. It would not have added anything new to it, and it would have restricted our insight about the artifact. As an explanation, the theory, in other words, felt laminated onto the film instead of derived from its unique features.
What is most likely to happen after searching for an explanation of your artifact is that you will find a theory or construct that explains some pieces of your artifact, but not all of them. It might explain one aspect or dimension of the artifact, but it doesn't account for all of the major dimensions you noticed in your initial coding. So in this case, you don't yet have an adequate and satisfactory explanation of the whole artifact.
This is the good news. If a conventional explanation for your artifact doesn't exist, you get to develop your own explanatory schema for it. An explanation that comes from your thinking about the data of your artifact. This is what makes your work original. Your objective in generating an explanatory schema is to discover a better explanation of your artifact than what was offered by the theories and constructs you tried out in your search for a conventional explanation.
An explanatory schema is a framework for organizing your insights about the artifact in a coherent and insightful way. It's an explanation of what is going on in the artifact derived from an analysis of the artifact itself. It connects all or most of the features that emerged from your broad brush coding of the artifact. An explanatory schema also can be thought of as a theory. The components of the schema are concepts or constructs in the theory, and the patterns among the concepts in the schema are statements of relationship or axioms in the theory. An explanatory schema, then, will be about some things, some constructs or concepts, and it will explain how those constructs or concepts relate to one another.
So, for example, the explanation we developed for Run, Lola, Run is an explanatory schema. Our explanation of the film is that it presents three different agentic orientations. It presents three different patterns of interaction that predispose individuals to a particular enactment of agency. An agentic orientation is composed of three components. First, a particular interpretation of structure, persons, places, and events. Second, the selection of a response to that interpretation structure. And third, the experience of an outcome in line with those choices. Each agentic orientation, then, has different conceptions of structural conditions. It takes a different response to the perceptions of those conditions, and it generates a different outcome. We labeled the three agentic orientations we saw in Run, Lola, Run, victim, supplicant, and director.
An explanatory schema does more than provide an explanation for what is intriguing to you about the artifact. It also serves as the structure of the article you will write to present your analysis. Its component parts are the headings and subheadings of the findings or analysis section of your essay. So in the case of our analysis of Run, Lola, Run, we organized our analysis section around the headings of victim, supplicant, and director, the three agentic orientations we identified when we wrote up our analysis, and we divided each of those into subsections of structural conditions, response, and outcome.
Although you can formulate an explanatory schema just by sitting alone at your desk and thinking, there are things that you can do to help speed up the process, to help you get some sparks going and to prompt you to move in new directions. One of them is something that you probably use anyways, brainstorming. One of the brainstorming techniques we like a lot for helping develop an explanatory schema is something that we call random stimulation. This is just a technique that helps you deliberately introduce apparently irrelevant and unconnected information into your thinking, and therefore helps you think differently about something. For example, you can open a dictionary, point to any word there, and then relate that word to your artifact and the categories that emerge from your coding in as many ways as you can think of. Another way to do brainstorming is to look around the room and select an object that's there. There, after you've selected the object, you want to create as many connections as you can between that object and your topic.
I use this technique to discover an explanatory schema for a group of artworks that intrigued me. And these were works of art known as body art that were popular in the 1970s. And these involved artists using their physical bodies as their medium of expression. These artists, for example, would bite themselves, for example, all over their bodies and then apply the paint to their bites and then apply that to paper. Well, I looked up from the desk where I was trying to create an explanatory schema, and I saw a picture of a clown on the wall. So I began connecting the clown to body art in as many ways as I could. And after just a few minutes, I had my explanatory schema. The clown wasn't the explanation I was seeking, but the insane person was. And I constructed an explanation around the notion of insanity, in which the viewer adopts the role of a therapist to make sense of the works. And I never would have developed that schema without the image of the clown as a prompt.
Let's assume at this point that, however you have arrived at it, you have an explanatory schema, an idea for an explanation of your artifact. The next step is to evaluate whether this schema will work as an explanation for your artifact. Does it really help you explain it? When you have a schema that explains the artifact well, you'll know it in two ways. The first way is that the schema explains all the key pieces of the artifact. Nothing major about the artifact is left hanging or unexplained. Everything fits. The features you coded earlier as a result of frequency and intensity should fit into or be able to be explained by the proposed schema.
A second criterion for judging a schema is whether it feels right. Now, this undoubtedly seems like a strange way to judge an explanatory schema, but a schema that really explains your artifact will produce a got it or aha feeling. When you come up with an explanation that addresses what intrigued or baffled you about the artifact, you will know that this explanation is the one. Now, admittedly, at the beginning of your scholarly career, almost any schema you come up with is probably going to feel pretty good. So to counter this possibility, try out two different possible explanatory schemas for your artifact. If they both have about the same amount of explanatory value, and neither one seems particularly better than the other, you know you probably don't have the best schema you could develop for explaining your artifact.
When you're trying to create an explanatory schema for an artifact, the process is often difficult. It can be frustrating and really can take a lot of time. You know something of significance is occurring in the artifact, but you're not yet able to articulate or explain it. Don't worry about this. Be patient. Sonia and her co-author went through three dramatically different schemas for analysis they did of Garrison Keillor's monologues. It took them several years. They kept going over different kinds of explanations for the monologues on the Prairie Home Companion. But finally, they found one that they knew explained the appeal of the monologues. Sufficient time and energy spent exploring the artifact will eventually yield an explanation that will enable you to understand the particular artifact better, and also, more importantly, to contribute to theory in your discipline.
We're going to end this first part of the teleconference dealing with generating and refining research ideas at this point, so let's do a quick review. We started out framing the effort to generate research ideas as something that should be done in the context of a larger research program. We suggested five methods for generating research ideas. First, starting with a question. Second, starting with literature. Third, using a conceptual conversation where you generate ideas in response to a partner who asks you questions. Fourth, keeping a promise file. And fifth, the generative method, where your idea for a research project is generated from a curious artifact or data that you encounter. We've now talked about four of the steps in this generative method. The first one is finding a curious text or data. The second is to code the data broadly to discover the major pieces that will lead to an explanation of that text or data. The third step is searching for an explanation that holds the pieces together and makes a contribution to your discipline. And the fourth step is developing your explanatory schema.
Our next teleconference, where we'll complete the steps in the generative method, will be next Monday, October 12th, at this same time, 10 o'clock Central Time. We'll be covering four more steps in that discussion. We'll be talking about using the explanatory schema to create a solid research question, performing a more detailed coding of that data to test the schema and to generate evidence of your claims. Third, conducting a literature search to connect your explanatory schema to conversations in your field. And finally, the framing of your study. At this point, we want to know if there's any questions about what we've covered today.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I really like the way you present method five. And I was wondering if you have any particular authors or text regarding this type of coding that I can go to that reflects what you shared. I'm teaching a qualitative inquiry class right now, and I think that the way you describe this would be very useful for students. So I was wondering, are there any particular texts that you would suggest I look at to share with the students?
Well, it's a bit of shameless self-publication, But most of these ideas are in our book, Destination Dissertation, and some people are using it actually as an undergraduate textbook now. But this book has a particular section on coding and on the conceptual, the explanatory schema. There's also a section in Sonia's book on rhetorical criticism, Sonia Foss's book.
If you look at the book called Rhetorical Criticism, it's the fourth edition. The very last chapter is on, it's called generative criticism, but it works for any kind of qualitative coding, and it essentially describes this process that we've just given you here.
Okay.
And also, I think we should also acknowledge that this is what we're suggesting here is really grounded theory.
Right.
And that, of course, comes from Glaser and Strauss.
Right.
But they do provide a pretty complex way of doing it, and we've really tried to simplify it a bit.
Okay.
And there's a lot of details in Destination Dissertation. It really walks through the coding step by step and talks about some of the decision making, and it gives a number of more brainstorming techniques.
Excellent. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions?
Yes, I have one. Can you hear me?
Very good,
thank you. I was wondering if you could talk a little more about the phase at which you have grouped your various observations about your artifact, and then you come up with sort of statements that I think you call thematic statements.
Yes.
If you could talk a little bit more about how you move from the thematic statements to this explanatory schema, because at one point you said that those thematic statements sort of become the pieces of the article that you're writing, and I didn't quite get how that flow is made.
Yes, and we didn't give as much detail as we usually would, but what we usually do is after you've grouped your themes into these piles, then what we do is we go to the computer and we just make a list of the labels of those piles. So, for example, if you've got in your piles gender and agency and time, okay, you just make a list of all of those. And then what we do is we cut those apart so that each of them is on one slip of paper. And then what we do is we go to our desk or somewhere and we lay those labels for our piles out in front of us, because we know these are all the major aspects of things that we've noticed that's going on in the artifact. And so then we start playing around with how might we organize them? How do they relate to each other? And so what you're really doing is playing around with, well, what theory do I have here? Or what explanation can I get by putting all of these things together in various ways? So it's really this process of moving them around, trying different ways to come up with the best way that you can organize these. You might find that three of the things are three major categories and everything else falls under them. Maybe you've got one major thing and everything comes out from that. But having the slips of paper that represent your piles, which represent your major topics, allows you just to go through multiple schemas for how might I explain this.
And if I can jump in, we're looking for a kind of an organic occurrence rather than just listing those thematic ideas together, saying there's six of them. We're looking for, is there a larger connection, an organic connection that holds them together? Let me just give you a quick example. We were working with a woman who was looking at cultural reproductions, how a culture reproduces itself, and she had thematic labels like cleaning and healing and teaching. One of the things that she found out was that the role of a mother, what a mother does with a child, covered many of those thematic ideas. And so the culture reproducing itself, the organic idea that she came up with was that, oh, it's a mother reproducing children and nurturing them. And so then that gave them an explanatory schema of how to see how the culture reproduces itself in a more complex way than just saying they do these things.
You've probably seen those articles where they did qualitative coding and then they say, there are five themes that emerge, and they just list those five themes. Well, we don't think that's very interesting, and we don't think that those people have done the real next step of analysis, which is to come up with this explanation that has to do with what's the relationship you see among those themes. And so that's where we think playing around with this organizational pattern for the schema gets you there.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Hello? Can
Hello?
You hear me?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes.
My name is Dana, and I'm a historian.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question because what I'm often having to deal with is a lot of data, you know, when,
mm-hmm.
like a correspondence of hundreds of letters. Do you have any, and I love your method here, but I'm worried about just managing all of that information. Do you have advice? I mean, that could end up a lot of slips of papers.
Yes.
Yeah,
actually,
we think that that's perfect. We've done this with historians a lot, and this is the way to manage. You really do get hundreds and hundreds of slips of paper, but this is a way to really be comprehensive about that data and to find a connection across all those papers. When someone tries to deal with them one at a time, they end up getting a thinner explanation. And there's a lot of historical works that fall into this. You know, what is it? Women in Cars in the West. I forget what that title is, but it presents things in this way. Sorry, I should know that title. Sonia, you're
referring
to
a specific book?
Yeah, I'm trying.
Oh, okay.
Shaft's a lot of work on Billy the Kid or the Wild West that is more explanatory than just listing the features.
So actually, again, in our destination dissertation book, we have a chapter on coding data,
uh-huh.
and we would recommend that you do it that way, which is go through your letters and make copies of them, and then in the margin, write a code that says what you're seeing, and then cut those out from your copies, and then sort them into piles, and then you'll know what your major themes are.
Okay. So, and you're very much, you believe in this mechanical cutting. There are no online databases or anything that you recommend using?
We have worked with lots of people who have tried to do that. What we find out, we really are committed to it, because what we find out is that the physical cutting, the brain interacts with the material very differently in that way. It's sort of a tactile processing, and there's a lot more subtle decision-making. The piles also are a lot more fluid until you're done with them. We didn't go through all the exact explanations of how we make these piles, how we evaluate them, and how we stabilize them. Those are all in the book. But the physical method produces, by our experience, much more profound results. Electronic coding and trying to do this on the computer tends to flatten out the exploration.
Also, we find that when people try to use electronic coders, they often either select or have to select their codes ahead of time. And so that, we think, produces original research.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Okay, well, that may be it.
So we'd like for you to join us next Monday, if you can, to finish off the steps.
Okay, well, thank you, Sonia and William, for
sharing your
expertise with us. And thank you all for participating in today's teleconference.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.